Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you.
Hello and welcome to episode 278 of Dogcast Radio, which lives online at dogcastradio.com with all our other episodes and lots of other dog-themed information and entertainment. Later, we'll hear from Lisa Sinnott about cats and dogs.
Scent swapping is really important. It can be, you know, wiping a cloth on them gently while you're stroking them, popping that in a zippable sandwich bag, plastic container, just posting that to the breeder or rescue centre, and also doing the same for the dog.
And we'll have a sneak preview of my latest project. And the reality of life with a puppy is hard. It's wonderful and terrible. So that's life at the moment. Wonderful and terrible. But before that, I'm talking to science writer and author Jennifer S. Holland. Good name, Jennifer, in my opinion, as that's my daughter's name. Jennifer Holland is definitely living her best life.
I was reading your bio. Wow, you've done some amazing things. You've flown in zero gravity over the Gulf of Mexico, dived with tiger sharks in the Bahamas, ducked below a reef shark feeding frenzy on the Great Barrier Reef, shimmied up the tallest tree in Costa Rica, gone cobra hunting with a bare-handed Vietnamese farmer, camped on an active volcano in Hawaii, crawled into a bear's den in northern Minnesota, sat fireside with bushmen in Papua New Guinea, learning to carve spears, and now you're on Dogcast Radio.
I am. It's all culminated. I've made it.
This is the pinnacle, isn't it? This is what it was all leading to. Oh, wow. That is just a dream career. Wow. I mean, for me, the one that really fills me with dread is like camping on an active volcano. Wow. How did you sleep?
It was, you know, there was a lot of booms and noises, and we were, you know, kind of off to the edge, but there was activity. It was pretty exciting. I don't think we slept very much.
No, I don't think I would have done. Oh, my goodness. Okay, well, brilliant. So we're talking today about dog intelligence, Dog Smart, your book, Dog Smart, Life-Changing Lessons in Canine Intelligence. I love it. And I love the fact that it's got so many heartwarming case studies, you know, real life dogs in it. It's absolutely brilliant. So to get to the heart of the real life dogs, let's just talk, first of all, about your dogs, Monk and Geddy. And you use them to make a point about canine intelligence. So can you tell us a little bit about them, please?
Yeah, sure. So we have two kind of unusual dogs. We have a Korean Jindo, and we have a breed called a Kai Ken, a Japanese breed. And they're very intelligent dogs. They're very stubborn dogs, and they have an interesting relationship. And I tell the story in the book about kind of how they have figured out the hierarchy in the house, and how I kind of noticed my one dog figuring out a way to take advantage of a situation and kind of be sly and get what he wanted out of the other dog. And I won't give it all away, but it just kind of got me really thinking about, you know, they're different in how they think. And they were, you know, he solved this problem. He figured out a way, and it was very clever and creative. And it made me wonder a little bit more about, you know, how smart are our dogs? We don't always give them credit, I think, for that.
Yeah. Yeah. I can remember very early on when I had my Labrador, and he was, I don't know, under a year, and he had a little toy boot, Wellington boot, and he was trying to stand it up on the edge of this sandpit. And I just watched him try and try and try to stand this boot up. I had no idea what he was doing, what he thought he was doing, why he was doing it. But clearly there was a thought process going on. And it just, I think the more you live with them, you want to understand them more. What are they thinking, don't you?
You do. And we, you know, we're not that great at it. I think, you know, even those of us who think we sort of get it, I think once you start to dig in a little bit more and try to think about how they experience the world, it's just, it's different. They're not necessarily thinking the way we are, and different things are important to them, and they need different kinds of opportunities in order to thrive.
Yeah. So. Yeah, absolutely. And because we have such different ways of perceiving the world and I guess priorities, it's very difficult for with any species to really think about how intelligent they are. So how do we gauge a dog's intelligence?
You know, there's a lot of ways. I think the way I approached it was to step outside of just the typical kind of dogs are smart when they learn our commands and they do the things we want them to do, and to think, well, what natural intelligence does a dog need to survive as its own creature? And they need to be adaptive. There's an adaptive intelligence that's kind of the base of everything. They have to be able to problem solve and figure out how to thrive in so many different circumstances. Their communication system is actually really robust and interesting and intricate. We don't always read them very well, and we probably are responding in ways that don't make any sense at all to the dog. And then, of course, olfactory intelligence is essential. That's their big superpower and the way that they experience so much of the world. So I like to look at these kinds of intelligence, emotional intelligence in addition. But they also, you know, there's scientists out there now who are training dogs to lie still in an MRI so they can assess what's actually happening in the brain and where when they're exposed to different experiences and voices and foods and compare it to the human brain and see, well, what happens in a human when they're happy and when they're sad. And so the tools are expanding for studying dog cognition in many, many ways. And behavioral studies, there's a lot of those going on as well. So yeah, it's great fun.
I interviewed Greg Burns about the MRI research.
Yeah.
One of the things I loved was he taught the dogs. One of the first things I think they were taught was, this is how you get out of the MRI. I loved that. They did. They were there by choice. And that was, I loved that.
Yeah. It is. It's fascinating. And the step-by-step that they had to take, which makes a lot of sense. Dogs learn like we do. You know, if you do it in small steps, they're going to learn it better. But to kind of watch that process and see what that looks like and watch the dog figure things out is really a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is. I mean, this is a really interesting area for me. Border Collies and German Shepherds, we kind of think of those as intelligent dogs. They're smart, they're clever. And, you know, and then we all have our own favourite breeds that we think, well, they're clever. You know, we live with a German Spitz Klein, and now we've just had a Papillon. And our first small breed was a Bichon Frise. And I was always a larger dog person. I'm a large person, full stop, but I'm a large dog person. I digress again. So, but the small dogs we've had have sort of amazed me, because I can remember when we had the Bichon Frise and she was the size of a guinea pig. And I can remember thinking, how am I ever going to teach this tiny little dog anything? She won't remember where the water is, you know, and obviously they do. They've just amazed me. So are some breeds sort of innately intelligent, or what's the situation there?
I would say, you know, genetics is powerful, and certainly, you know, we've been selectively breeding some of these breeds to be intelligent in certain ways, whether it's a border collie for that intensity and that attention that they pay to things. They're so aware and so sensitive to detail, and you're going to see, you know, a lot of border collies have that, but of course they're individuals. And so you're going to also see plenty of border collies that probably aren't that into some of the jobs maybe that some of them are. But I would say, you know, giving dogs opportunities, sometimes you bring out intelligence that you didn't realize they had. And there was one study I write about in the book where they compared German Shepherds and pugs in a sniffing task. And of course, German Shepherds are used all the time in these kinds of tasks, and you would expect them to excel. But the commitment that these little pugs had, you know, with their smushed little nose, they don't even look like they would be able to sniff at all. They actually excelled and did better in some of the tasks than the German Shepherds. So you're not going to probably see a lot of pug police dogs out there for other reasons, but they were very, very capable. And it was something that I think was surprising to everybody. So opportunity is essential to bringing out the intelligence of a dog.
Yeah. I absolutely agree. And I know someone with a pug, Susanna with a pug, who she adopted the pug. And at that point, the pug was called Marshmallow, because she was big and white and, you know, overweight. And Susanna has done agility with this pug, you know, not forced, but the pug took to agility. And she's Marsha now. She's not Marshmallow. And she whizzes round and she's amazing. And, you know, she's breaking down so many prejudices about pugs, you know. And I think we do that at our peril, really, whether we go, oh, Labradors are good with children, or whether we go, oh, another breed is a bit sharp, or another breed is a bit, they're just a catch potato. You're right. We deny them the chance to enjoy opportunities, don't we?
Yeah. And then, as you say, you know, if we make an assumption about a dog is going to be good with kids, for example, or we make an assumption that, say, a pit bull is going to be aggressive and mean, and so our shelters are all full of pit bulls because people are afraid, So in both directions, I think we make the mistake of making assumptions about a breed that aren't necessarily consistent at all across the breed.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're all up in arms about, you know, breed-specific legislation, saying it's wrong. And then when you go about, you know, yes, you can make generalized statements about breeds, but they, as you say, they're going to be individuals, aren't they, with their own preferences?
Yes, thankfully.
Yeah, yes, so, absolutely. Because it means there's a dog out there for all of us.
That's right. At least one, maybe three.
Let's hope. So there's a lot of research involved in the book. So tell me about sort of the field research and some of the trainers and the experts that you spoke to.
Yeah, I was really fortunate because it kind of all started with the pandemic. And so I wasn't sure if I would be able to go out and do field research at all. But a testament to these wonderful people that knew that this was really important to me, you know, made it work. And I spent time with cadaver sniffing dogs that are trained, you know, to find both modern scenarios and ancient remains, hundreds of years old. These dogs are helping to find the edges of cemeteries, for example, that were never marked from hundreds of years ago. Mm-hmm. I was at the Seeing Eye in New Jersey, and I got to walk with a Seeing Eye dog and feel what that's like to have this dog making these decisions and, you know, just putting all of my faith in this dog to make this journey. Incredible experience. The conservation sniffer dogs, the trauma dogs that, you know, sit in a courtroom with a child and help them sort of get through a situation. They're so emotionally intelligent. They're just so connected. They know just what to do and not to do depending on the demeanor of the child. A wide range. One fun one, I was on a boat with a dog who sniffs whale scat as laid in the ocean before it sinks. And it helps the scientists to go out and get samples because they're trying to understand a little bit more about the health of the whales. And that's the much easier way to do it than to actually try to capture a whale and take a blood sample. So, but the dog, it's incredible to watch this dog sniffing off the side of the boat, and depending which way, you know, she's going, the driver is driving the boat, and sure enough, there's the whale poop floating. So
I mean, that's dogs are interested in poo anyway, and you know, it's never long before I start talking poo, let's be honest. But
I'm right there.
But I mean, the dogs, the insights into wildlife that we're getting from the dogs being able to sniff the poo and tell us that the poo is there, and it's opening up insights that, like, we know things that they, that for example, pine martens choose habitats that we didn't think they did, and yet there's the poo, so they've been there, they do go and explore these areas we would have gone won't be there, you know. So they're teaching us so much.
They really are. And they're now using, they're training dogs for on vineyards to help them find, you know, invasive species and fungal infections. And, you know, they really, in terms of just how we make use of them in our world, they're incredibly useful. And the key is, of course, to just give back and make sure that we're not just using them. We want to make sure they're having wonderful lives.
Yeah.
And but the working dogs I met all seem to really love what they're doing. There was not a case where I felt sorry for the dog. They wanted to do it, and they get excited, and they want to do well. They wanted to get it right. And regardless of what the reward was, some it was food, some it was playtime, the military dogs don't really get rewarded because they don't, you know, it's just a different kind of training, but they just wanted to get it right. And it was remarkable.
Yeah. Yeah. They do enjoy having a task. I mean, I guess they're getting the reward of the praise from the owner, from the handler,
right.
But you know, but they do enjoy having a job to do. And intelligence is it's sort of a two-edged sword. And I've seen this with children, that you're the naughty children, in inverted commas, in a class are often the more intelligent children, that you're not stretching enough. And it's true with dogs, isn't it? Sometimes those dogs who make, and again, in inverted commas, bad pets, challenging mm-hmm. pets, they make fantastic working dogs, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. They put all of that attention into the job. But I think, you know, even still, just that bond with humans and the desire to get it right, and which pleases us, you know, there is something to that being a part of their reason for doing those jobs. And it's such an incredible relationship. It goes back thousands of years, and we've shaped each other. We've shaped each other's genetics. We've shaped each other physiologically. There's just a lot of change that happened over the course of our relationship with dogs that we just never would have expected. It's remarkable.
Yeah. And they fulfill their part of the bargain without reading a book or studying, don't they? They just go, yeah, I know what to do.
Yes, exactly. Now they're remarkable animals.
Yeah. I'm just thinking at the moment, we have German Spitzklein, who's 6, and we have the Papillon puppy. They are standing up to the process of getting to know each other much better than I am, I think, because a lot of times I'm like, please, guys, can we just stop for a bit? And can I just go and get a coffee and a rest? And they're like, you know, yeah, come on, let's go again. Let's try again. Let's, you know. And so, yeah, they're very resilient and they're taking it much better than I am.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I think that's often the case, isn't it?
Yeah. And I guess actually talking about the kind of the different roles that dogs do for us, from, as you say, leading a blind person to sniffing out various things to comforting us, therapy dogs. Do you think they all have different kinds of intelligence then? And again, that may come down to breed, it may be individual characters, but they have different kinds of intelligence.
Yeah, that is my sense of it for sure. You know, and I think again, individual dogs, there are some dogs that are just more kind of emotionally in tune with you. You know, my dogs, two of them, one of them is not really emotionally in tune. He's very, and it's partly his breed. He's a Korean Jindo. He's just a more standoffish kind of dog, but it's also just his individual, you know, he was a rescue dog. We don't really know what his history was with people. He doesn't really want to look you in the eye. He kind of turns his head away. He's, you know, he's less comfortable being hugged, but he will lean against you. He sort of makes those decisions and choices. Whereas the other is much more, you know, if I'm feeling a little down, the other dog is going to come over and sort of, you know, seems like the one who's more in tune with that. And so I think you see just a broad range across individual dogs, definitely tendencies in a breed, but not necessarily a full consistency there.
No. Yeah. But isn't that true? Like you have friends, one has friends that some are huggers and they'll come and give you a big hug. And others sort of will sit by you or bring you a coffee or, you know, say something kind. So we all express, you know, we have our own bubble of personal space, don't we? And dogs are the same. And I think that's really important to let dogs be themselves, you know, and appreciate that and go, well, this is what you're comfortable with. This is what we'll do.
Yeah. And that does take some, you know, just appreciating your individual dog and accepting what it is that dog is comfortable with. You know, one of my sources said it's amazing our dogs don't eat our children more often because we're so primate, you know, we're always in their face and we want to hug and the kids, you know, rushing up and screaming and dogs, you know, generally are going to tolerate most of that without doing us any harm. But to be more aware of that and to think about, well, that's not natural for a canine. You know, that's a human thing. That's an ape thing. And to not expect your dog immediately or a new dog that you're just meeting to you know, enjoy all of the same things that your, you know, childhood golden retriever maybe enjoyed.
Yes. So. Yeah, absolutely. I think dogs thrive and do so well, sometimes despite us, not because of us, but, you know, they kind of do it anyway. And that brings us to another important point. So what's the difference? You've mentioned there that sort of that what we've bred dogs for, we've bred instincts into or out of them, you know, we've tried to shape them into something, a tool for ourselves, if you will. And it may be a tool we love, but we've tried to shape them into that. So what's the difference between instinct and intelligence?
I mean, instinct is really that automatic thing. It's just in there. It's the fight or flight. It's the thing that, you know, at the very, very base of survival. Whereas I think of intelligence as something that can be grown and shaped and stretched and expanded and has, you know, so many different components to it. You know, I think we miss a lot of the kinds of intelligence in humans by our IQ test, for example. And I talk a little about this in the book, that there's other ways of being intelligent, other ways of solving problems and, you know, that don't necessarily fit into the usual categories. And I think that's absolutely true with dogs as well. And that's why I kind of took the approach I did in the book.
Yeah, yeah. And really, you wouldn't dream of judging the intelligence of another person by how obedient they are.
That's true.
Why do we do that with dogs, you know?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And sometimes not being obedient is smarter, yeah. You know, depending on the circumstances.
Yeah.
So Absolutely. We have to keep that in mind as well.
Yeah, yeah. And it always, you know, when people say, oh, he won't do something unless there's something in it for him. And you think, but...
Of course.
Yes, I mean, we go and get the job with the best pay, you know, the best wage we can, because there's got to be something in it for us as well. You know, that surely that is a mark of intelligence.
Yeah, incentive. And, you know, the training now is all about positive reinforcement, positive incentive, which makes so much sense.
Yes.
When you think about how, you know, we were used to be taught to train your dog was to dominate and, you know, hold his nose in it if he goes in the house. And, you know, we grew up with that. And I feel terrible now at how we yelled at the dog and just expected them to magically understand what we were going for. It's like, this is a different species from us. It's amazing that we get along as well as we do and that they tolerate the things that they do. But, you know, give them some credit for having a mind of their own.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And some to give them some choice sometimes, even if it's just sort of, what would you like for tea? Would you like this one or this one or dinner? You know, which way do you want to go on the walk? You know, it's just simple things. Do you want the harness or the collar? Just if you can, build some choice in. And it's lovely to see them relax a bit and go, oh, yeah, that's better.
Yes, I absolutely agree. I love that. And yeah, giving them more time to sniff and to run if you have a place for them to run and just letting them do their thing and not be so ready to get in there and, you know, pull them apart. The dogs that play rough, you know, you obviously have to be careful at a dog park or something like that. But dogs have their own way of communicating and playing. And it's nice to give them the opportunity to just do it their way and not be constantly interfering with them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, I mean, your job sounds wonderful. All the experiences you've had. I'm so jealous. It sounds wonderful. And on top of that, you have got to meet some fantastic dogs, haven't you? Tell me about some of the dogs you've met.
Oh, boy. Let's see. Jasper was a wonderful dog out, a young woman that trains her dogs for conservation work. And I spent some time out in Washington. We walked around on campus looking for buildings that have old architecture and there's toxins in some of the caulking on the windows. And her dog has been trained to find some of these so they can do remediation. In some of these areas, we also went out into a wild area where the same dog can find wolf scat, can find and knows wolf scat from coyote, from dog, from, you know, and knows, you know, a certain species of salamander versus another species of salamander. Just remarkable. And just the sweetest black lab you could ever know, you know, just also a wonderful pet dog as well. So that was wonderful. A dog named Fletch who does this old ancient remains sniffing. And we went out to an old fort site in Florida where they're finding, you know, old bones where there was a cemetery that wasn't marked, and getting to watch him search around and find these areas where these bones used to be. There's nothing even left in there, but somehow the dog can still pick up something that's different in the soil. And then this dog that smells whale scat. I can't get over it. Just from the boat finds the whale. Just amazing.
Incredible. You've just triggered a memory there. When years ago, gosh, I was a teenager and we had a German shepherd. My mum had a German shepherd and I was walking the German shepherd with a friend and we happened to just go past a graveyard. And Ben just got up on the wall and just looked like this. And he was just being nosy. And my friend went, can he smell the bones? No, I don't know. Maybe he could. But it just made me laugh.
It is amazing. I mean, you can train them to smell anything. Yeah. The scientists don't really have equipment that can yet figure out just how sensitive the nose is, but they know they can smell. The concentration can be in the trillionths and maybe even the quadrillionths, which is 15 zeros, as I think I came up with, because I couldn't even comprehend what that means. But when they say, you know, a drop of blood in a swimming pool, that kind of thing, it's absolutely true with dogs. They can pick up on the tiniest, tiniest amount if you train them on that scent.
Yeah.
They can find it. So.
Wow. It's just incredible. That's just mind-blowing, isn't it? That's wow.
It is.
Wow.
Yeah, the olfaction is a big part of the book because it is so interesting.
Yes.
But of course, there's a lot of emotional stuff in here as well and a lot about communication and adaptation as well.
Yeah, yeah. So a lot of our dogs, we sort of, they get a 15-minute go around the block and then they sit on the sofa for most of the day. And, you know, but can we do activities with them, or how can we encourage them to be more intelligent?
I think opportunity, just as you would with a child, you know, something, if they seem to thrive on something, if they get a lot out of it, if they do want to sniff, you know, can you give them more opportunities, whether it's on a walk or whether you have the time and the money to give them a class, you know, something where they actually get to do the thing that they seem to love to do. You know, there's nothing wrong with couch potato time with your dog. I wouldn't say everybody has to suddenly change everything about their experience with their dog, but just outings, taking them with you, they love it. You know, most of them, again, your individual dog, maybe your dog doesn't like to go in the car and then don't. But if your dog is one of those that just wants to experience things, it's just a matter of, you know, can you come with me today? Yes, you can. Let's go do this thing. And I think that just that exposure to more and giving them opportunities to use their different kinds of intelligence is going to help expand it.
Yeah. And that all sounds like stuff that we can do, you know. Yes. OK. As you say, yes, we may not be able to afford, you know, all the classes or even a class. There's lots of things you can do at home and you can do activities for free, you know, and I'm a great one for finding activities that you can do for, like, with packaging, you know, safe mm-hmm. packaging that you can hide treats in a box for the, you know, stuff that you get from Amazon or wherever, that you can do that with the dog for free. It's stuff that you would just recycle. So yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
There's lots of resources out there online, just, you know, games you can play with your dog, brain games. And it's, yeah, very simple stuff. You don't have to have special equipment or a special location. You can just do it right there in your house. So
yeah. Excellent. Excellent. It's a fantastic book. It's a fantastic subject. And thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
Gosh, you know, I guess I would just say I know most of us, probably the people listening, we all love our dogs and we have this special relationship with them. But I think, you know, what I've sort of taken away is just to step back a little bit and try to see the world that they're seeing a little bit more and appreciate kind of what that means for them. And, you know, I don't spray if I have perfume or something. I'm more mindful about, you know, my dog has 300 million olfactory receptors. Maybe I shouldn't spray this, you know, right there, because who knows what he's experiencing. Or, you know, the vacuum cleaner, maybe there's some other high-pitched whine that I can't even hear that's bothering him, and that's why he's afraid. And just trying to keep in mind the different things that we maybe didn't really understand before about dogs and applying them day to day, I think is the thing to do.
Yeah. The next time I don't do the cleaning, I'm going to say, Jennifer Holland said, I am not to vacuum for the good of the dog, you know, mental health. Absolutely love it. Where's the best place for people to find out more about you online?
I have an author website, jenniferhollandwriter.com, that needs a little updating, but the new book information is on there. And the book is available in all the usual places online and in the brick and mortar stores that are still out there. So
excellent.
Take a look.
Excellent. Thank you ever so much, Jennifer. That's been really interesting. And I can't wait to see what you do next. You'll be off into space or something now.
I hope so.
I'll be honest. I think our dogs are more intelligent than me. Hey, what do you mean you already knew that? All the links Jennifer mentioned can be found in the show notes at dogcastradio.com.
You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com.
Many of us love cats and dogs, and many of us live with cats and dogs. But how do we ensure our cats and dogs are as happy living with each other as we are? One person who has the answers is behaviourist Lisa Sinnott.
Really excited. You graduated in clinical animal behaviour from University of Edinburgh last year. So you're science-based. I love that. You're ethical. You're kind methods, aren't you? So you're everything we're about.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I graduated there in November. Me and my mum went up for the day, well, the weekend. And yeah, graduated up in Curran Hall. Saw lots of faces that I'd only seen on Zoom. And it's an online course.
Yeah.
I did some shadowing of some clinical animal behaviourists as well, just to solidify their learning. But yeah, it was a wonderful day.
Yeah, brilliant.
Lovely. Yeah. Lovely time. Glad I did it. Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. I love science-based, you know, trainers that are talking from the science as well as experience, but from the science. And we're not just going, oh, this method works. We need to know sort of why does it work? What's the dog's or the cat's experience? You know, whatever the animal is, what's their experience of this? Are we giving them a good experience, or are we just shutting them down? What's, you know, going on? Yeah. As much as we can speculate. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Can sometimes train behaviors. If the dog's barking at the door, you might train them to go to their mat, but it might not actually get the emotion behind the behavior. Like, they might still be scared if it's a fear-based reason that they're barking, so it'll pop up somewhere else.
Yeah.
You're quite right, you need to kind of dig a bit deeper and find out the motivation and emotion behind the behavior as well.
Yeah Well, I guess the training is the easy bit in a way. That's just the, you know, I always think what gets treated gets repeated kind of thing. And the training is the sort of the behaviours we want, but the behaviour is the looking a bit deeper. And that's when clever people like you come into it and sort of say, well, actually what the dog's feeling is this or that, you know, and help us to give our dogs the best experience we can.
Yeah, I think it can be easy to misinterpret behaviour sometimes.
Yes. Yeah.
We're so close to our animals as well. So kind of having an outside view or really being equipped in feline and canine body language, kind of thinking, you know, why are they doing this behavior? What body language are they showing? If their tail's wagging, obviously that doesn't, I'm sure a lot of your listeners will know, it doesn't always mean the dog's happy. It's all about the position of the wag and the other body language that they're showing as well, and taking a holistic view on kind of their sleep, their food, their exercise, any pain that they might be experiencing, any stresses from outside or inside that they might be seeing as well. So yeah, a full picture, just like us really. I guess if we're stressed sometimes, it can be a few different things accumulating, and that we can act in a way that we wouldn't do normally hadn't the other stuff happened. And the same thing can happen with dogs and cats too.
Yes. Yeah. I think a lot of our listeners have cats and dogs. We certainly have cats and dogs. We have three cats and we're back to two dogs at the moment. Yay. But it's a lot to sort of manage and to support all the animals. And we'd got sort of a status quo where we'd got the three cats and we'd got Mischief, and they all sort of knew each other, and it was all lovely and going along nicely. And then I wanted to introduce a puppy, which we've done, you know, and it's like, oh my goodness. And every new beginning with a dog or a cat, I'm always frightened that I won't be able to get to the same level of understanding with this kitten or puppy that I've got to with the other ones, you know. And it's always, I find new beginnings scary because I suppose it's the unknown, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Different cats and dogs have different temperaments. So yeah. But I mean, I guess if you've got lots of experience, that can be a really good foundation if you've kind of been there before.
Yeah, it kind of helps, but I always have that fear of I won't be able to do it this time. So we'll see. We'll see. So well, thank you. So you're someone who knows what we should be doing when we're introducing cats and dogs. So let's jump in. What do we need to know about introducing cats and dogs?
Sure. So I wanted to kind of do it in three-pronged approach, if that's all right. So things to think about before you even get a cat or a dog.
Excellent.
So obviously considering the breed of dog you're planning to get if you've got a cat, obviously dogs that are bred to chase, things like greyhounds, they might not be suitable for living with a cat. I'm not saying everyone, but you know, it's thinking about those breed specific traits initially before welcoming a dog home. Also, if you've got a cat or a dog and you need to also think about if they've had any previous negative experiences with other dogs or cats, because obviously that can imprint on them. Do you have the space as well? We'll be talking about it a bit later, but having separate areas for the cats and dogs initially is really sensible to help them feel safer.
Yeah.
If you're getting a dog, has the dog been around cats from a young age? Otherwise they might think, oh, this is really, really exciting, and chase it. And also just the temperament of your cat as well. You know, can you test this out? If you've got a garden, can the cat go out into the garden and watch the dog from maybe the garden table, have the door open so they can run back into the house if they want to and move away? What's their reaction? You know, if they're freaking out and they're really scared, you know, is that going to be a sensible thing to do to welcome a dog home?
Yeah, yeah. So I guess sometimes the answer might be, well, it's not going to be suitable at the moment. You know, sometimes if we put our animals' needs first, it might be that we think, well, we'll have to delay getting the dog or the cat.
Yeah, I think it's really sensible to think about, because especially if you've got an elderly cat that, I don't know, maybe that's arthritic and can't jump up as high and climb as easily as it used to, that's really potentially going to affect their well-being, because if they can't go up high, obviously cats are a prey and predator species. So if they can't escape a dog easily by running away from it or, you know, climbing up high, that can really affect them. So I think that's an important consideration, really.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, we want to go into it making sure they're as happy and safe as they can be, because, I mean, it can with the best of intentions and in the best regulated households, it can go wrong, can't it? So how do we, you know, when we've assessed our cat and our dog, we think, well, actually, we think they might be able to cope with it. You know, we're going to try, we're going to do our best. So what's the best way to actually introduce them?
Sure. So it kind of starts even before the dogs come home. So I'll do this from a dog perspective. Imagine that the cat's got their territory, which is your home already.
Yeah.
So scent swapping is really important. Obviously, cats navigate the world through their sense of smell. So it's really important that they're able to smell the dog rather than just being able to smell it when it's arrived, because they'll hear it as well. Potentially, they'll see it. So doing that groundwork beforehand. And scent swapping will be different for every animal. For some cats, it can be, you know, wiping a cloth on them gently while you're stroking them, popping that in a, you know, zippable sandwich bag container, plastic one, and then giving it to the person who's got the dog, either a breeder or a rescue centre, and also doing the same for the dog, and then just leaving that around the house for the cat and for the dog to smell. Remember that they're still in separate houses at the moment, and just see what the reaction is. If the cat is interested, that's great. If they kind of run and hide, then doing things more slowly. Otherwise, if, I don't know, the cat doesn't like being stroked, then maybe one of their brushes or a toy or a blanket that they've laid on. Obviously, making sure that they've got other blankets to lay on so we're not taking their scent away. But then also doing scent exchanges on things like the table and other areas that the cat might smell and be around.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that, because that's getting straight to the heart of like what it is to be a cat and dog, cat or dog.
Yeah.
It's because we're really visual, but they perceive the world primarily through scent, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think it can be really overwhelming, you know, if they're just smelling a dog, or a dog's just smelling a cat straight away and then hearing it and then seeing it, you know, it can be, oh, what, you know, what's that? So, you know, setting the groundwork and putting that bit of pre-work in. Just posting that to the breeder or rescue centre, that's a really good way of helping things get off on the right kind of paw, if you like.
Yeah, excellent.
Sometimes cats can get stressed. Not every cat, like lots of cats and dogs I've known living harmoniously together and really happy and get on really well. Obviously, some cats, you know, they can get really stressed, and that can sometimes end in things like cystitis, and that's, you know, pain peeing and, you know, peeing outside the litter tray. So doing everything we can to help prevent that. Obviously, there can be other reasons for cystitis as well, but stress is a cause of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So this is a really gradual introduction, isn't it?
Yeah, and in terms of other things that you might like to do in terms of setting up the house, thinking about a cap flap if your cat does go outside. A cap flap that's higher up rather than ground level can be good, so they can see the dog when they are coming back inside the house. Whereas obviously if it's really ground level, they can become nose to nose with the dog. And then always having options to get away. There's things like cat trees or cat shelves. If you didn't want to do that, then there can be other variations, you know, a high table that they could go on, or, you know, a windowsill, something high up there. But it's really important that they're not running the gauntlet to kind of get away from the dog.
Yeah.
And obviously elderly cats, there'll be different considerations there because they might not be able to jump up on raised surfaces. Climbing up with steps and things might be a better idea.
Yeah, yeah. So I get trying to make it sort of gradual and gentle as we can, but also we're giving them a way out, aren't we? We're not sort of forcing them together. In every situation, yeah. We're sort of trying to make it that they can step away if they need to.
Yeah, that's really important. I think, you know, I get it. We're very goal orientated. We can be a bit addicted to outcomes, kind of that Amazon Prime. I want it mentality, but you know, our dogs and cats are different. We don't just want to shove them in the room together. And so they're spending time together, flood them, you know, it should be on their terms and as slowly as possible.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I mean, you know, I think this a lot. I mean, I am very, very frightened of wasps and bees. And I always sort of take it to that and sort of think, well, you know, I can cope with bees and wasps at a certain distance. And if you think about whether kind methods are better or, you know, I was thinking the other day, if somebody hit me hard enough and went, you jolly well sit still while there's a bee and wasp here. Yeah, I would do it. I wouldn't be happy. Yeah. I'd be panicking and I might well turn on that person who hit me. You know, it wouldn't be a good experience at all. Whereas if somebody sort of said, right, come and get this Mars bar or this piece of cake. I'm very food motivated, you know, but you have to come. Yes, you have to come a little bit closer to the bee or wasp. Yeah, I'll do that. I'll do that. There will come a point where I'll go, that's, you know, my limit. I'm not going to get any nearer than that. But if you kind of think what you're frightened of and what you can cope with, and then think about the dog and cat trying to sort of cope in the same way, it's much, much kinder, isn't it, to sort of to go at their pace, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you hit the nail on the head there. Yeah, at their pace, you know, they'll tell you, you know, the pace that they want to go. Some cats will be different and dogs will be different and more confident than others, but slow and steady is more sensible, just so you've got the time to judge things and see the body language rather than kind of being in this frenzied state where everything's going wrong and then,
yeah,
you know, first impressions count. So yeah, setting them up for success.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Now we've got a puppy at the moment. I keep mentioning we've got a puppy, we've got Diamond, and she's a little papillon. Our cats are used to a dog, the puppy isn't used to cats. So we're using a crate. So she's really happy in the crate and we're pairing the... So we've got her in the crate, we're bringing her in, we're giving her treats, letting the cats see her, we're keeping the sessions short, you know, that kind of thing. Because, you know, the last thing I want is her... Because she's very high energy, she's fast. I don't want her... Well, I don't want anybody getting injured. I don't want the cats to injure her. I don't want her to injure the cats. So I'm being really, really slow and steady.
That's brilliant. Yeah. So you've got three cats, is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, you're quite right. Cats have sharp claws. Cats will tend to flee rather than fight if they've got options to escape. So things, you know, being able to move away. I'm sure your listeners will probably think about resources. Obviously, during the actual arrival, setting up baby gates can be really helpful just so your cat's got that option to move away and the dog's not rushing forward and their resources are there because, you know, dogs are interested in lots of different things, litter trays, you know, cat food can be very enticing as well. But having an area for your cat to be in that's just theirs for initially, obviously keeping the food and water bowl separate and the litter tray separate so no smells are contaminating, but just so they've got that safe space to, yeah, that's upstairs initially.
Yeah, yeah. You're bringing about memories there because Buddy, my Labrador, was obsessed with the cat litter tray. That was like, ooh, pudding, you know, to him. It was horrible.
I know. Yeah,
revolting. how much do cats and dogs understand each other? Because obviously we're trying to understand both of them. We're speaking English or whatever language we happen to speak. But and then we've got the language barrier with each of them. But how much do the cats and dogs understand each other?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, people say cats are harder to read. I think they can be because they mask pain really well. One of the first things, because obviously they're a solitary survivalist, it's not ideal for them to look vulnerable and hide pain. But if you look closely in terms of their body language, things like licking their lip, they can lick their lip very quickly, or their nose, just like dogs do. They can have very like low, slinky body language if they're a bit unsure of things. I think cats will make it very clear if they're really upset. You know, they'll might or, you know, claw at a dog. I think obviously cats as a prey species don't know that a dog initially just wants to play with them, even if, you know, if a dog's chasing them and just wants to roll around with them. To a cat, actually, that can be really quite scary. Mm-hmm. They've never experienced that before, even though the dog's motivation and intention is just to play. You know, the cat's never had that, then it's very hard to communicate.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, rolling on your back, where if you're a dog or a cat, can have quite different meanings, can't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. On Kendall Shepherd's ladder of aggression, obviously, if a dog's lying down with their leg up, that doesn't mean that they want a belly rub. And again, cats, when they show us their bellies, it can be that they're very relaxed, but it doesn't mean that they want a belly rub. I know some people out there will say, oh, my cat loves a belly rub, or they'll love me, you know, putting my, you know, even head into their belly and smushing them. But it's very different you doing it to compared to a brand new dog that's just come home.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. It's like, you know, our close family and friends, we love a hug with. Most of us love a hug with. But if a stranger comes up and tries to grab a hug, you're going to be like, whoa, get off. I don't know what you're going to do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's like being in a lift with someone and, yeah, feeling a bit, you know, uncomfortable, maybe getting your phone out or looking at your nails. You know, cats will feel safer if they've got other things to occupy themselves with and move away from dogs. There's, you know, things like, even depending on obviously how big your dog is, but the back of the sofa, them being able to run behind that and jump up on a table. That's something I read in Sarah Ellis's book and John Bradshaw's book, The Trainable Cat. That can be quite a good idea. So they've got that escape point.
Yeah, yeah. Do we always have to start? I mean, obviously, usually we have an adult, you know, a cat or a dog, and we're bringing quite probably a puppy or a kitten in. Can we do the same? Can we still introduce them if we're starting with two adult animals that may not be familiar with the other species?
Yeah, I think it's easier from a younger age, just because you haven't potentially got that learning history of negative experiences.
Yeah.
And obviously age considerations, obviously as we get older and our cats and dogs get older, they might be less tolerant, they might be experiencing things like arthritis or other things. It's not impossible, but I think training the dog with some basic commands just to, you know, prevent any chasing, you know, stay in way, learning to settle, eye contact on you, using a long lead, not a flexi lead, because obviously that can cause injuries inside the house and outside as well, but just minimizing those risks of any chasing happening. Because, you know, neurochemically for a dog, chasing something's really fun. You know, thinking of, you know, a squirrel that they're chasing or a bird, you know, to them it's really fun, and if they're getting a chance to do that, then they're just going to repeat it. So I think it can be done, but I think, you know, considering those steps that we talked about initially would be the best course of practice if you can.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So,
can you go outside? You know, that'll be another consideration.
Yeah.
You know, is it indoors all the time?
Yeah, yeah. So can you tell us some things? Like, what are things that we definitely should do? And maybe, you know, as well, what are things that are definite no-nos? Don't do that if you want this to go smoothly.
Sure. So I'd say definitely don't just stick them in a room.
Yeah.
Don't, you know, just give them a puzzle feeder each or a licky mat or some food. Don't, you know, just put them next to each other and the yeah. bonding activity for them to eat. You know, as humans, a lot of us like going out for dinner. We're very social. We have wine. We have 3-course meal. But cats, they eat alone. You know, in the wild, they would have, you know, hunted for up to 20 times. Not all of the hunts would have been successful, but they eat alone.
Yeah.
So even if they are eating next to a dog or eating next to another cat, it doesn't mean that they're, you know, really comfortable. So I'd say that'd be my first thing. Do's, I'd say, you know, getting some real basic cues, commands with your dog, learning to settle, learning to wait, some eye contact, and initially having barriers.
Yeah.
In the first instance, just so they can see each other, I drape a blanket over the baby gate. You can get glass baby gates because obviously, you know, with some baby gates, they're very small slits. So if you've got a kitten, maybe they could go through. You definitely don't want any heads getting stuck. But, you know, pop the blanket over it so they can see each other, but then they can also move away if they want to. And then gradually introduce some food, but far away from each other, not right up against the gate again.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the way. Yeah. But allow them to investigate calmly. Yeah. And calming activities as well, not kind of like jack in the box puzzle feeders that the dog might pick up and crash on the floor. Some cats will be fine with loud noises, but obviously their hearing's incredible. Well, it would have to be because of all the mice they've had to catch in the
yeah, yeah.
Just thinking about it from a kind of cat's point of view.
Yeah. I mean, the odds are, well, hopefully the odds are that you will succeed if you go slowly and, you know. But, I mean, I guess at the end of the day, sometimes you just have to make sure that they can have their own territories, you know, steer clear of each other if they want to. You know, you can't always push animals together into the shape of life that you want, can you?
Yeah. I mean, some cats and dogs, you know, might find them curled up on the sofa together, but some cats and dogs, they might just, you know, tolerate each other from afar, and, you know, that's fine as well. Having realistic expectations.
Yes.
Really important.
Yeah, which is difficult because when you I'm finding this now, when you've come from a place where your dogs and cats will sort of cuddle up and be all civilized together, you know, I'm like, oh, can't we get back to that? But, you know, I'm trying to be patient and hoping it will happen. So yeah, this is great advice for me at the moment. This is perfect subject. Oh, is there anything else you'd like to say that we haven't covered yet?
There's some tips on my knowledge centre on my website, my dog one, stpawstrainingacademy.co.uk, my cat one, stclawsacademy.co.uk. But if anybody has any questions, please feel free to reach out.
Yeah. I mean, maybe if we get some questions, we could always meet up again and discuss some questions, because it is it's a difficult subject area, isn't it?
Yeah, it can be. It's, you know, there's lots of things to consider, but I think having a really good grasp of dog body language and cat body language so you can spot signs is a really good first.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Do you think as well, if you think things aren't going well, do you think ask a behaviourist sooner rather than later?
Yeah, I think getting help sooner rather than later is really sensible. I saw in a Facebook group someone like, oh, why do you have to get a behaviorist? The dog hasn't done anything yet. It's like, well, you know, that's good that the dog hasn't done anything yet.
Yeah.
Keep that way. Or the cat, you know, that person wasn't talking about dogs and cats, but, you know, having the idea that you need a behaviorist when everything's, you know, being thrown out of the bath water and there's been tears involved and you're really upset and you're really stressed, it's not a great way to be. Yeah, reaching out for help when you can, you know, despite the best intentions, you know, it's life. Sometimes things go wrong and it's no one's fault necessarily, but, you know, even if there's something that we have done that we wouldn't normally do, or we made a mistake with some things, lots of things can get rectified.
You don't know
and there can be lots of different factors.
And as you say, a behaviorist will look, just somebody that with fresh eyes, without the stress of trying to cope with it 24/7, comes in and goes, well, do you know what you need to do? And then they can read the animal better, you know. And it just, it's such a help when somebody looks at it and goes, no, it's not, look, it's not a disaster. It's, you know, you've got lovely animals. They're just not understanding each other, or whatever the situation is. You know, there's lots of things they can do. And also, too, I mean, that thing about, oh, the dog hasn't done anything yet, why do you need a behaviourist? You know, I've just put my car in because the brakes, I can tell there's a problem, they're like beginning to squeal. I'm not going to wait until the car, the brakes fail and the car crashes. Until then, I go and say to a mechanic, can you have a look at the brakes, mate? Because I've just crashed the car. And I think, you know, I go and get them done before there's a big, big problem.
And it can be, you know, it can be scary sometimes asking for help.
Yes.
You know, you don't know what the behavior is like, or, you know, because it's unregulated profession as well, that can make it trickier. Or I'd always recommend looking, you know, for testimonials, people in the Association of Pet Behavior Counselors or FAP clinicians, they're educated at university level. But really thinking about, you know, how your life would change for the better if you got the support from someone, you know, looking at testimonials, having a chat with them beforehand.
Yeah.
And it can be a good thing to do.
Yeah. And being honest with them, because I think a lot of the time, you know, as we've said, by the time some people, a lot of us, come to talk to a behaviourist, there have been things happening that we're not terribly proud of within, you know, whether we've done things or the cat or dog has done things, you know, you live with it and you go along with it. You think, well, it, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, for example, so it doesn't matter if the cat's peeing or pooing everywhere, you know, we'll cope with it and we'll clean it up. So by the, you know, that's just an example. So by the time you come to talk to a behaviourist, you've got some baggage and you're thinking, oh gosh, should I say this? The behaviourist won't be shocked, will they? Tell them the truth.
Yeah, it's really important, you know, that you're working with someone that you trust and you give them a full picture, because there can be so many different elements that contribute to the behaviour. I don't like, you know, kind of this idea that it's always the owner's fault. That's completely not true. You know, animal behaviour can be based on genetics, temperament, you know, even stress that's been transferred from the mother, the dam in the womb, to the dogs. You know, previous experiences, pain, you know, so really being honest with the behaviorist about things that you've done or other people in the house have done, and they'll just guide you on why that's not recommended or whether you should keep doing that. They'll be honest with you. Not in a judgmental way, but just giving you the options of why that's not recommended. Because, you know, you only do things because you want an outcome.
Yes.
And you've got your pet's best interests at heart. And sometimes it can be really hard to know what to do, especially, I don't know, if there's things on the TV, you see something, you think, oh, that's like my dog. But, you know, dogs and cats, they have different motivations and emotions for behavior. So, you know, trying something just on Google or TV can be like pushing a triangle into a square hole. Yeah. You know, it doesn't look, you know, the reason behind why your cat and dog's doing it. So I think that's important. Otherwise, you can get a bit frustrated and give up or be trying things that's just not right for your dog or cat.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's perfect advice. Keep your cat or dog or whatever the animal is, but keep your animal at the center of your thinking and try and meet their particular needs.
Yeah, I mean, I remember like reading, you know, magazines when I was younger of like, you know, oh, if he doesn't call you back, then it means, you know, that he's just not that into you or he's dating someone else. You know, the kind of these labels and these boxes, you know, actually, you know, you might be at work or maybe, I don't know, he's poorly or you maybe, you know, it could be different reasons. I think just labeling and, you know, an animal as, you know, dominant or being naughty or overzealous, it's not really helpful because it doesn't get to the reason behind the behavior. It's just a label. It doesn't actually describe why they're doing what they're doing. It's just a label.
I love the way Lisa puts the emotional welfare of the dog and cat at the heart of what she's doing. We have the links to Lisa's dog site, stpawstrainingacademy.co.uk, and her cat site, stclawsacademy.co.uk, at dogcastradio.com. If you have cats and dogs, I'd love to hear about it and see photos. You can email me or find me via our social media. And talking of social media, I've been recording my thoughts on welcoming Diamond, my Papillon puppy, to the family. To manage expectations, I'm calling it the inane ramblings of a puppy owner. Hashtag Iropo. And I'll be putting all of that on YouTube. And here, just for you, is a sneak preview. This is the reality of May in England, probably most of Britain. It's raining. We had 1 week. We picked up Diamond on the 4th of May, Star Wars Day. May the 4th be with you. And we had a glorious week that week. In fact, at times it was too hot for me, but it meant it was brilliant. We could be out in the garden, and toilet training was so much easier than it could have been if we were trapped in the house by rain. And a lot of pees and poos were done in the garden rather than the house. And so that first week was brilliant. But then after that, the weather turned and it's been very rainy since then. And I know we Brits talk a lot about the weather, but this is why, because we never know what we're going to wake up to. And it can be more, you know, hotter than you can handle one day for a Brit, hotter than I can handle. And one day, and then the next day it's rainy and chilly and you need your cardi again. Yes, your cardi. Your thermal vest, probably. Anyway, it's May and it's raining and I'm under an umbrella, as you can probably hear. And luckily, Diamond loves water. She sloshes the water out of her water bowl and she paddles in it and she does not mind coming out and getting drenched. So that's a good thing. That'll be on the Dogcast Radio YouTube channel soon. But for now, that's it. The end of another episode, all of which you can find at dogcastradio.com. Until next time, look after yourselves and your dogs. Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. What kind of car does a dog drive? A Ferrari.